Welcome to a podcast of Authoring into Retirement, Too Much Invested to Quit, presented by J. David Hunger, Emeritus Professor of Management at Iowa State University, Strategic Management Scholar in Residence at St. John's University in Minnesota, and co-author of Strategic Management and Business Policy, 12th edition, Concepts in Strategic Management and Business Policy, 12th edition, and Essentials of Strategic Management, 5th edition. This podcast was recorded at the 2010 Text and Academic Authors Association Conference in Minneapolis, Minnesota. TAA is the only nonprofit association with members dedicated solely to assisting textbook and academic authors to enhance the quality of textbooks and other academic materials by providing them with educational and networking opportunities. For more information about TAA, go to http://www.taaonline.net.
Welcome, I'm David Hunger, officially J. David Hunger, because my father's name was John. They didn't want to call me Junior, but they called me John. So they ended up calling me David, and I didn't know my first name was John until I had to register for the draft when I was 18. So my insurance people, I'm John Hunger, and other people, it's David, and I don't know who I am, but it doesn't matter. Who cares? Anyhow, on the book, it's J. David Hunger. It sounds kind of official. So I basically just live 80 miles up the road from here, St. Joseph, Minnesota, just on the other side of St. Cloud, and thought GTAA is right here in Minneapolis, so I thought I'd just drive down and attend the meeting for once. I've been here a few years ago. I'm currently teaching at one course a year at St. John's University, College of St. Benedict. They're combined. One's all men college, other one's all women college. They have it combined. It's all confusing, but it seems to work. I've been for many years at Iowa State University. That's why I'm also emeritus professor, which has certain privileges, but I've left Ames, so I can't get much access to them anyhow, like free parking or something, or share an office with 10 other people. I don't know. And that's supposedly a nice honor, I guess, and so here we are. The reason I'm bringing this up is because I haven't heard anybody else talk about this stuff here at TAA, and most people don't have much interest in the idea of, now that you have a textbook, getting out of it. It's always, how do we get into one, and how do we find out about it? How do we do that, and all that kind of stuff. And I know a colleague here, Denise, mentioned yesterday, why are you interested in getting out of it? Too many problems with publishers? And of course, when we listen to the presentations here, it seems like the publishers and the editors and everybody are all out to get us, and it's sort of like working with the mafia or something, you know. They're evil, devious, and whatever. And my response was, no, that wasn't really it. Yeah, sometimes it is a problem. But we also forget, too, that co-authors are often just as big a problem, and sometimes even more so. Because when you get into a textbook, especially with a co-author, it's a marriage, and the book is one of your children. And if you have multiple books, you have multiple children. You have a family. And everybody wants the right thing for their child, but everybody thinks it's a little different. So there's a lot of different conflicts that you get into here. The question that I'm here today talking about is, what happens when you get to the point where you're thinking about backing off, retiring? And the question is, should we continue authoring into retirement? Or do I have too much invested to quit? There's too much money, there's too much ego, there's too much other things. What else am I going to do with my life? I've got to continue with something. Why not this? Well, I actually wrote a paper that was accepted, and then I turned it into PowerPoint, since they said you got to have a PowerPoint. But I'm going to just start off. I'm going to read a little bit from the background and then the conclusion, and the in-between stuff is all PowerPoint. So we'll go to that. I've got handouts here. And contrary to one of my colleagues, I'm handing them out in advance. That way, if you want to really leave and go to the Mall of America before lunch, you can. Okay, in order to become a successful textbook author, one must commit a lot of time and effort to the project. We know that. We talk about it a lot. One must ignore the constant pressure from colleagues who often put textbook writing in the same money-grubbing category as consulting, to put more attention on publishing research papers in top journals. That's what they want. Although the royalties from a good-selling textbook are gratefully appreciated, and I'll be the last one to say no to that, pressure from the publisher and the marketplace to prepare editions every 2 or 3 years and to do related books and supplements can reduce the time to do other things. Taking on the additional responsibility of being a department chair or some other position is nearly impossible. One finds that it's important to continue teaching the course for which the book or books were written in order to try out new material and exercises. Family vacations must be scheduled around due to dates for chapter submission, copy editing, page proofs, and either writing or reviewing the instructor's manual, test point, PowerPoint slides, and maybe a video. And if you're not providing it, you're going to have to check over somebody else's to see that they're not actually turning everything you said upside down and backwards. Providing the constant updates to the users of a textbook via a website can help sell books, but also can become very demanding. I mean, we're talking about constantly updating your stuff. A successful textbook author soon realizes that the book, interesting, I've always referred to it as the book, even if it's maybe multiple books, and other people who are in the business refer to it as the book, because that's how it's referred to by your spouse and your kids. That's on the book. That's how they talk about it. It dominates his or her life, both professionally and personally. The author tends to ego-identify with the book and consider it his or her baby. The reality is that authoring a textbook is really like having another child. Nevertheless, children do tend to grow up and leave home. If it's successful, a textbook can last for 10 to 15 editions, a very long childhood. When is a good time for a textbook author to call it quits? A, when the publisher points to falling sales, I don't know, looking bad. B, when the royalties are no longer worth the effort, when you could teach summer school for the same amount as what you're getting the royalties for. Or C, when the fun of authorship actually fades. Why am I doing this, just for the money? Oh, man. Assuming the book or books are still selling well, which mine are, does it make sense to continue writing textbooks once one has retired from a teaching position? Should one continue revising textbooks while in retirement because the author has too much invested to quit? Well, that's why I prepared this, and hopefully all this stuff will work. Let's see, that's back. This is forward, maybe. Yes?
If you have any problems,
I've got an authority. Thank you. And he did so well last time. Yes, thank you. Okay, this is just credentials. Okay, what do I do? What's my stuff? Okay. Strategic Management Business Policy, 12th edition, first published hardbound 1983, first started working on it like 1978, 79, and all that kind of stuff. Received TAA's McGuffey Longevity Award for its 6th edition back, I think, in 1991. Also have Concepts in Strategic Management, 12th edition. It's a paperback split, and maybe you're familiar with these kinds of things. In Strategic Management, it's a capstone course in all business schools, undergraduate as well as graduate level. A rule of thumb is 40% of the book is text, and 60% of the book is cases, composed of cases, a series of cases of actual organizations that students will look at and debate in class and this kind of stuff. So it's a clear candidate for a split, where you can split out the concepts portion, sell it separately as a paperback, and the cases portion, split that out and sell it separately as a paperback. So that's done. Cases in Strategic Management, the paperback split is no longer published after the 10th edition, because people don't want to get all 35 of those cases. They'd rather just go through Harvard or even through Prentice Hall and other various organizations that will sell them the cases individually and package them for them, in effect, custom publishing. And then there's Essentials of Strategic Management, 5th edition, first published paperback 1997. First publisher was Addison Wesley. We went with them because we want to avoid the big monster publishers like Prentice Hall that everybody knew. Basic reputation was they'll sell your book, basically they'll throw all the new books up on the wall, whichever ones stick, that's who they'll promote. And we thought we wanted somebody who would work with us past maybe the first year, you know, or maybe the first edition perhaps, rather than just dumping us if we didn't weren't perfect the first time. So we avoided Prentice Hall, McGraw-Hill, all those nasty ones, and went with Addison Wesley, seemed nice, cozy little family firm, and all that sort of stuff. Now, I thought we could do an essentials book, which would be collapsing all the text, which is about 400 or 500 pages, down to less than 200, and that could be really cheap, because I was realizing students want cheaper books. and I'll just cut out all the stuff, you know, all those discussion questions, cutesy stuff, black and white, nothing else, basic. And they were fighting with me because they said, nobody has an essentials book and strategy now. So why would we do it? And I'm thinking, wait a minute, isn't that the reason why you wouldn't do it when there's no competition? Aren't we trying to... Well, after a long time when they had to do break-even, they finally figured out they just sold maybe 3,000 copies in the whole life of its edition, which could go on, who knows, forever. They could break even, so all right, they give it a try. Well, since then, we've got all sorts of essentials book now, and it's doing really well. And what's great about it, the kids actually keep the book because even it doesn't, I renew it, I revise it every 4 years, but the royalties and the sales are the same every year. They don't drop off. So it's short, it's cheap, and they keep it. So I don't have that many in the used book market. Interesting, I find, very interesting. So anyway, I've been happy with that. And Prentice Hall, they bought us out. You know, Pearson, now it's all everybody. Now we're back to Prentice Hall again. Anyhow, and then of course, Instructor's Manual and Essentials Book and all that stuff. And it's all author prepared because we felt that the key for using cases, the authors have to be able to see an analysis of each case in depth in a nice manner so that they can figure out which case would be the best one to assign in their course. So it had to be a teaching manual that we would prepare because we didn't trust anybody else to do it to our level of quality. So that's a certain another amount of work that we've had, we've taken off on our own. Okay, that's basically it. The issue, my thesis, not proven, just a thesis. The successful textbook authors ego-identify with their books. Over time, the book becomes like another child, one that demands constant care and feeding, but is highly valued as it matures. It really is. Parents eventually learn to let their own children grow up and leave the household, but when does a textbook author let go of his or her baby? That's the issue. Forward. Okay, what's the positives? And it was interesting to see discussion of this the other day. Let's see, it was Michael Spigler. I don't know if Michael's here or not. Yeah, I attended his presentation where he was talking about, are you interested in writing a textbook? And he was talking about a whole series of things. He didn't get into the pros and the cons, but he got into a number of these things. And so when we talk about why do you want to write a book? Well, clearly there's a number of things, which Michael mentioned, and I'm picking them up too. Becoming a published author, that's an ego boost. Wow, to be published. Your family and friends think that's really great. Boy, my brother the professor, no, the author, you know, wow. Being acknowledged as an authority in the field for all of us, if we're in academia, that's a big deal. That makes a big difference to us. Help determine what's important in the field. When we put together a textbook, we are picking out of the journals those findings that are the most important, will have the most impact in the field in the future. We, in effect, help to define which of the journal articles is going to live and which of them are going to die. Now, okay, there's always going to be a few, it doesn't matter what I write, are going to live. But the vast majority of the stuff that we jam, put out, you know, and I've done journal articles too, dies. You know, they have a life of about 5 years and then bye-bye. Textbooks is how you get remembered a little bit and tied into a stream of research. Royalties provide freedom and other goodies, really, for four different reasons. One is the less need to teach summer school. Teaching, I don't know about you, but when I started teaching, the amount of salary they were giving me didn't take care of my family budget. So I had to teach summer school and evening courses or whatever else to get the cash. And then maybe I can back off of that. There's less need to consult and to do what we call dog and pony shows in business schools and stuff like management. We used to do, when I was teaching at University of Virginia, we used to do dog and pony shows where we'd go out to the federal government, to state government, to different companies and put on presentations, week-long things on motivation, leadership, decision-making, communication, performance appraisal, employee selection, all this stuff for, you know, like $100 an hour. Okay, and we're always on the road somewhere. They're just road shows. You get tired of that. You get really, and your family keeps wondering, when are you going to be home, Daddy? Well, when I'm teaching a course next, that's it. Provide extras. You know, you get to have a new car, a bigger house, tuition for college kids, you know, that kind of stuff. And you're no longer dependent on one job or region for income. See, I really was tired of being at UVA, and I wanted to move back to the Midwest, and Iowa State had an opening. But I couldn't have afforded to move, even though they're going to pay me more, because I have to give up all that local dog and pony show and consulting income, which is all local. I couldn't just, you know, go that long distance. With the textbook now, I get royalties coming in no matter where I write it. The money comes in the door or in your wherever. And so I can live anywhere. I can be with any university. That's really nice. So that freedom, part of the reason why I got into academia, need for autonomy, need for freedom. Well, there's also negatives. Notice the list is longer. Now, they're not weighted, you know. The weights probably are still stronger on the total positives. Otherwise, why am I still doing this stuff? But here, these are things we got to keep in mind. Colleagues don't value textbooks as research. They press, particularly people at University of Virginia or Iowa State University, they press for more empirical research in top journals. And the top journals are always getting more and more and more prestigious and more selective and whatever. They classify textbook writing as teaching and consulting. That was the most insidious thing they were doing that Iowa State that really bugged me was that say, well, we're going to have teaching, research, and service. It's all going to be equal. And then they said, no, teaching is 40, research is 40, administration and service, that's 20. Well, okay, that's equal. Well, then what we're going to do is textbooks. Okay, well, we're going to have teaching research. So we're going to have research and research, empirical research. And then we're going to have teaching research. And textbooks are now teaching research. Therefore, I was already doing, like, getting a 9 or a 10 out of 10 in teaching. So basically, now I went from a 9 or a 10 to a 10. Whoopee. And then my research was now zero, you know, unless I was doing journal articles and top journals, which then they would count at different levels. So, you know, I come out great here, lousy there, and then I'd get a, you know, performance evaluation. So that's how you're dealt with. You know, pretty much you're marginalized at major universities, and that's a problem. You must prepare new editions every 2 to 3 years. I'm on a 2-year revision cycle because, again, if we're selling cases in the book, the cases are all pretty much used up after a couple years, so they've got to have new cases. So clearly, the push is to come out every 2 years. So I'm always writing the book. And you must do related books and supplements because you've got to keep those going too. The teaching manual, all the PowerPoints, and all the rest of the stuff. Okay, you can hire people to do that, but then I take a look at what they've done. And I, God bless America, what is the matter? And I have to go back and correct them. Only a few new textbooks ever go to second or third editions. That's another thing to keep in mind. I mean, that's a negative if you're just going to get into it. I don't know the figures, but I've heard people say that if people have put together a proposal for a textbook and are actually starting on it, very few of them actually finish it. I don't know what the percentage is, but even of those that actually get it finished, that are published in first edition, no more than 50% ever make it to the second or third edition. I don't know if that's true. That's just what I've heard. But the impression is, and I don't think it's far from the truth, that it's really hard to get a book going that lasts, that has staying power. That's unusual accomplishment. You must teach the same course as the book. I'm teaching oriented. The book is teaching oriented. I have to write to the students, so I've got to try out the stuff with the students. So I have to keep teaching the course that the book is written for. The family gets less attention. Deadlines come first. Okay, we all know. You've been on the vacation. If your textbook, you know what I mean. On vacation at the lake somewhere, and I got all my page proofs of going through, and my little FedEx envelopes and the forms I've got. So then I got to drive the 10 miles to find wherever the darn FedEx box or UPS, whichever one the publisher lets me use this year, and drop it off, and this kind of stuff. And yeah, that's my vacation. And so, Daddy, where are you, Daddy, now? Are you, you know, that kind of stuff. Less time for real research or administrative responsibilities. The book takes on more and more time. It takes on more of it as the book expands and spreads out, and it's a shorter revision cycle. You're always on the book. There's very little time available left to do empirical research, and you certainly would never agree to be department chair unless somebody had a gun aimed at your head. And even then, forget it. I guess I just take the shot. I mean, I don't see how I could do it. But the other problem is you're doing the same thing over and over again. That was something I was telling Denise. The same book I wrote back when, 1980, I'm keeping it up to date. Yeah, I'm staying up with my field, yeah. But how many times can I keep doing the same thing over and over? It's in the 12th edition, now it's going to be going into the 13th edition. I'm tired of reading that same stuff I wrote. And there's a couple paragraphs that haven't changed from the first edition, you know, just a few. And I can't see the errors anymore. I can't see the errors. I know what I've written. I can close my eyes and recite chapter one, you know. That's a problem. So it gets boring. Co-authors often fight over who does what and when, and that has been a problem in my situation with my co-author. And if you talk to others, I'm sure you've had problems with co-authors. My co-author thinks that all editors are witches from the East, or warlocks, whatever term you want to use, and refuses to talk to them. My editor comes, sends me an email saying, it's time to think about the 13th edition. We're going to send out a review. What kind of questions would you like them to ask? We're going to do, And I know my co-author, Tom, will never respond to her at all. He won't talk to her at all. Just, we can set up a conference call. Yeah, for me and the editor. That's not a conference call because Tom will never be available, right? That's always, he refuses. So I'm the guy in the middle. When they can't get a hold of Tom, who's in Tampa, Florida, St. Petersburg, actually, I'm in Minnesota, and the publisher's in New York or New Jersey. They have to come to me as a shortcut to get to Tom because he never answers his phone. He screens all his calls and will never respond to the editor. I mean, so here I am. You know, after a certain number of years, you get a little tired of being the clown in the middle. I mean, I feel like I'm in Belfast during the bad days, you know, and Tom, the Irishman, is throwing the bombs over at the publisher. Ha, 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 bam. You know, can't trust these evil demons and this kind of thing. And everything she says is always taken evilly. And of course, after, so we get into these battles. It has been a problem because sometimes I may have a relationship with the editor and I'm talking about some of my problems that I'm having with my co-editor, co-author. I should never do that. I should never talk to your editor about problems you have with your co-author, because they then, one of the things that they'll do to gain advantage, going back to the conspiracy theory of publishers, is that they will try to pry you apart so as to get concessions from you to do more, and then they'll have more power to the extent that you two are fighting. So they always would prefer you co-authors are fighting. And Tom and I basically are old friends, and so we'll always get together, and when push comes to shove, it's us against them. And that's how we basically worked it. And why is it good? Because we've never had the same editor on more than one edition. 12 editions? At least 12 editors, maybe 14. Other people have had a similar situation. So don't become buddies with your editor, because they're here today, gone tomorrow. And the other thing that really gets me is, other than the first editor and our first edition, to my knowledge, none of them have ever read our book, any of our books. But they always want to change it. They always have suggestions on what to do with it. I just find that totally amazing. I've asked them straight out. Well, no, I haven't quite gotten to that yet. I've been really busy. I mean, I find it kind of wild and crazy. Okay, those are some negatives. Let's see, I think that's where I am. Yes. When's a good time to quit? When sales drop off and the editor is ambivalent about the next edition, you get these mumblings. You don't have to quit then. I've known other people, Les Digman, University of Nebraska, for example, has done a strategy book, strategic management book. And his editor, maybe it was Wiley, maybe it was somebody else, didn't think it was selling very well, and they basically wanted to dump it. Les wanted to continue with it. And so he got them to release the book to him. He could then go out and find a publisher that would publish it all in black and white and a reduced amount and not as much marketing and whatever it is, and continue to sell the book, you know, much as other companies will buy old brands that don't do very well, like Pepsodent toothpaste that used to be advertised years ago, still selling because somebody could pick it up. And there's always somebody who still wants to buy some Pepsodent. And we see this kind of stuff going on all the time. So Les is able to continue to sell his book in multiple editions. So you can do the same thing if you want. But that's the first question. Is it time to quit or not? Secondly, when royalties are no longer worth the effort, and my rule of thumb is, if I can make more money teaching summer school than I can writing a book, I'm going to teach summer school, even though it's a pain. Boy, it's a lot easier. As somebody, I think, yeah, it was earlier on getting into a textbook. If you look at how much you get paid by the hour, you're probably 50 cents an hour. Amount of all the work you do into it, researching and doing all this stuff. So it's not very lucrative, textbook authoring, until you get the check, then you feel real good. And if it fits with your professor's job, then it fits, because again, the idea is synergy. You want to have it all support each other. So I don't do anything for one thing, I always try to do multiples, for the classroom, for journals, for this, for that, for the book. Or when the fun of authorship fades. At first it's exciting. As was pointed out earlier, you get that first book that you've done. It is great. Wow, you open it, you can't stop looking at it. Wow, I wrote this. I did this. It's me. Wow. It's great. It is. And then the next edition, some next edition, some, you know, after a while, gee, that's great. I like it. That's fine. And it's sort of like not so hot anymore. You know, it's like your first car, your first kiss, or whatever it is. After a while, it fades. Okay, I'm sorry, but it does. And so at what point is the fun gone? And then we go back to the positives in terms of why you do the book. And for a lot of us, a lot of those reasons may be fading except for the royalties. And then that's why we get so hung up on royalties and protecting them. That's the one thing that still sort of drives us, because we definitely get that stuff in the mail. But then we get retirement age. And as we say, it's time to slow down and smell the roses, isn't it? Is that the time? You're 66, but you haven't quit yet. You're still teaching full time. You still got your textbooks. You're still on the saddle. Pardon?
You're confused by that, aren't
no,
you?
No, I know people who are doing that, and that's okay. It's just that my wife and I got together, we decided, when you come back time to retire, there's a series of decisions you have to make. One is, where are we going to retire? When are we going to retire? Where are we going to retire? The first when comes up when you have to go on to Medicare. You got no choice. At 65, you got to go sign up and do all that. That, bam, is a kick in the head. Right off the bat, you know, whoops, I'm different. And then the whole payroll thing, and you get into that, and who's paying what for which insurance, and blah, blah, who's primary, who's secondary. Okay, that all comes in. Then there's Social Security, of course, which comes in, blah, 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 66, 67, depending on your age, when you were born, all right. That's another kick when you actually are up to that. You know, wow, I could get full Social Security. When your university keeps telling you, gee, what about early retirement? When they keep urging that on you, you start wondering, gee, what's going on here? But part of the question is, you can retire in place. That's what you haven't done that yet. But a lot of people do. You have, right? You're at McAllister College right here in St. Paul, Minneapolis. And you've retired from there. You're still doing your textbooks. They give you an office in the basement of the engineering building where there's old nuclear power stuff still. No, it's all the radiation safe. They tell him, he's past, having kids. You know, so what's the difference, right? He glows in the dark. So what? We're just joking. We're talking about that. But you got your little place, and you still do your books, and it's okay. You know, you can attend the local university stuff. You still got your friends. You go out to coffee with them. That's fine. The other one is, do you want to retire where your kids went and the grandkids went? That's another one. Trouble is, they keep moving. So how many moves are you going to make? And the other one is to go where you used to vacation. A lot of people used to go to Arizona that reason, or Florida. Now Florida's getting a little filled up and messy, and Arizona, I don't know if they're going to run out of water next or not. But nevertheless, we went to Minnesota because that's where we vacationed. Okay, so I come up here, and then I meet some people in St. John's. Hey, we'd love to have you. And it's a small school. They're not accredited and all this kind of stuff. So, hey, a textbook author, that's a big deal. Wow, somebody who actually thinks it's a big deal, this is amazing. I'm with you guys. So that's the other piece of it. Your decision on where and when and all that kind of retirement thing comes in. So if you're leaving, then obviously that gets me into that whole retirement mode. Well, assuming the book still sells, mine does. Textbook-oriented activities probably constitute half of the author's professional activities. That's why you're working. If you're working full-time, I'm willing to bet that half of your professional time is spent on your textbooks. Yep. The other half is on teaching and service, whatever else, and consulting, sure. But half of your professional work time is textbook. It's connect, and for some of it's more. Okay, it takes up a lot. The royalties may equal or exceed your teaching salary. I was amazed that I was getting close to retirement when my royalties actually exceeded the salary I was getting. Now, it took a long time to get to that, and it's all been probably inflation. I don't think my sales are that wonderful. But, the cost of textbooks have gone up, and the royalties tied to sales. That's pretty good. So that kept me, this is nice. But with age, it takes longer to recover from extensive work activities. Your energy declines, and you can do less. We see it with sports athletics. Professional sport player. Professional athletics is the word I want to use. A big controversy in Minnesota is Brett Favre, the 40-year-old quarterback. I think he's only 40. He just turned 40, and everybody's over the hill. But he still keeps coming back. But you notice, what does he have to do to come back? In his younger days, let's go out partying. Let's have fun. The next day, play a great game. As you get into your 30s, you can't just go out partying every night. You got to go into the whirlpool. You got to go into this. Now Brett Favre is into his early 40s. He goes to the hospital for his operations, And he may or may not be back because he's coming back for another operation, which means he may or may not play for the Vikings this next year. All I'm saying is all of us have these issues. As we get older, our energy, the amount that we have, we can expend it. We can still do the same thing. We can still run that marathon. You're a marathon runner, right? Yeah, you can still run that marathon. But the amount of days it takes you to come back before you can run another one becomes not just days, but weeks, months, maybe years. It takes a lot longer. Now, you can say you can be in great shape, but my argument is to stay in that great shape, you have to put more and more and more time into it. So the time that you use expending the energy has a cost, a higher cost, as you get older. So your energy declines, you can do less, it takes longer to recover from it. Retirement is a time to rethink life priorities. What do you want to do with the rest of your life? And if you ever attend these retirement seminars that universities often provide for you, that's one of the big issues. TIA Kreff will come in, give you a nice talk. The basic issue is, what do you want to do with the rest of your life? One thing we do know is that if you're college people, TIA Kreff says your lifetime expectancy, if you're a male, is 89 years of age. Female faculty member, 90 years of age. No, I don't know. That's what TIA Kreff told me. Is that the faculty life expectancy that TIA Kreff uses? I don't know. I'm 41, so I don't know. But all I know is that's what they were setting me up for. It's once you get to that, is at 65, you're very likely to have 25 years of life expectancy. Now, I don't know what the probability is, and maybe it's all dependent on whether it's 79, 89, or 20. I don't know.
Your average life expectancy is about
20
years. I'm not sure.
20 years? So it'll be 85. Every time she speaks, it's going lower. I'm already dead. I didn't know it, you know? You're absolutely right. And that may be, they're talking about younger people can expect to go, I don't know what it is for me. But for planning purposes, they were suggesting, T.A. Kreff does, planning purposes, plan for living to 90. Because if you get to 90 and all your retirement's gone, it could be a problem. Okay, so that's their push, is don't waste all your retirement income in your first couple of years having parties. Yes?
David, this is fascinating to me because you're setting it up as almost prescriptive. These are the things you should think about. I find myself feeling very descriptive about this. TAA has never studied this through surveys. I wonder if...
Where do they get it?
If you looked at the population of textbook authors in this country who have retired from any other full-time enumeration, I would love to find out what from this or other motivating factors they define as what's keeping them ticking.
That's a good point.
I'll share with you this.
Yeah.
I do not predict that my royalties are going to exceed what my academic salary will have been unless something wonderful happens that I don't see any often in the next few editions.
Well, since I can no longer have an academic salary,
I misunderstood that one.
No. When I was making $100,000 at Iowa State, and when my royalties hit $100,000 one year, I was just amazed. Truly amazed.
I don't envision mine getting there. That, okay.
But this book is for required course. And that kind of stuff. So it has a large audience. Retirement is still a time to rethink. And you can decide whatever you want. But my argument is doing the same thing for 20 to 40 years can get boring after a while. Unless you're getting into different textbook, different areas. I'm not sure. I get bored, and I like to try some new things. And I'm not sure how long do I want to continue. I'd like to write some fiction. I'd like to do some other things. I'd like to get into some hobbies like a lot of other retired people do. But I'm always busy at work, right, in my basement, on my computer. It's not possible to cut back on textbook activities. Editors demand new editions on schedule. So it's really hard to say, I think I'll lay out the next revision. My co-author, could you just take it this time? Only if I'm willing to take the whole one the next time, maybe. No, they're not just going to say, well, instead of having a two-year revision cycle, let's go to four for just next year. No, they won't do that. But I can do it with teaching. I can drop out, I can get a sabbatical, I can get a leave of absence. I can quit for a while and get another job somewhere else. But I can't give up my textbook and expect to get it back again. It's a different ball game. It's like selling your house. Hard to get that house back again unless they don't like it for some reason. So my restrictions on where I cut back are limited. A common first response, and I'm generalizing from my own experience, and I admit that, and that's a fallacy of the stuff I'm presenting. One is phased retirement, and you cut back on your, quote, real job, or other people call it your day job, what you're teaching and other related work, where teaching is doing phased retirement. What it means is instead of teaching both semesters, you teach one semester, you're off the next semester. And what I did was try to be smart. I'd always teach the spring semester, so I'd have off the fall semester, which was basically good weather time to travel, but also because that's when they set up committee assignments. So I could never be on a committee when I'm back teaching in the spring. See, I just pick it up, and all I do is teach my classes. Bye, guys, see ya. And that's okay. So at that point, teaching is just one quarter. I got no service activities at all, unless I feel like it, and I never do. And then the textbook is three quarters. So now it's assuming three quarters of my work activity. Then I go to full retirement, because we decided we want to move and go get a house on a lake. We're moving to Minnesota somewhere, find a house. Okay, you get your gold plaque and your roast. And the roast is always fun, you know, when they come up and tell all these funny stories about you. It's great. Sign little things. Bye, bye, bye. We'll miss you. And now you become what? Now you become a full-time textbook author. So you go from two jobs down to one job. But the one job is now full-time because you have nothing else to do, so your textbook now takes on everything. Oh, God, wait a minute. Did I do the right thing? Because work expands to fill the time available. It's called Parkinson's Law. And problems with authoring into retirement, problems that I found, okay? How do you try out new material if you're not teaching? Ooh, you just guess? Students will love this. You're no longer supported by your school to attend conferences like this. Bail FedEx or UPS to your co-author and publisher. Or free access to journals. You know, you get in there and you can go into the library or you can get online, you know. Once you're gone, you're gone. You get no more job rotation. One of the ways in which in management, when we'll try to keep people somewhat motivated, we'll have job enrichment, where we give people more say over their job. Job enlargement, we give more to do, which sounds kind of crazy, but it does increase motivation in some instances. And there was job rotation, where you move them around from one job to another. You get tired of driving for a while, now you get out and walk for a while, right? And we know change is good. But there's no more job rotation. There's no more teaching one time, then do a little bit of this, and see some students and whatever. Multitasking, I like that. It kept me more energetic and invigorated. Now I'm just sitting in the basement doing my textbook. And there's not enough time to enjoy the golden years, especially if your co-author is older. I'm 69 years of age. My co-author's 75, 76, and he's got health problems, serious health problems, and he wants me to do more. And I want to do less, you know. So you get some problems here. And your wife, your spouse, is wondering, you're retired. Yeah, everybody says you're retired, and then you have all excuses you're doing something else. After a while, it gets to you. So a temporary solution to three of those four problems is you can teach part-time, which is what I'm doing. You can try out new materials for the book. You get a change of scene. You get out of the basement study. You talk with academic colleagues. School might provide support for the textbook, copying, journal access. That's how I got those handouts run off. I went into the office there and punched in the management code and ran them off, and nobody cared. I'm not going to get support to here, you know, because I'm just part-time. I teach one course. But some travel support sometimes if they have some extra money, which seems to be less and less. It doesn't help with enjoying retirement. It's just job enlargement for lower pay. I went from Iowa State, where I was making $100,000 teaching four courses, to St. John's, where I'm teaching one course for $4,500. Kind of weird. But I didn't mind the trade-off. Possible options. Okay, what do I do now? So this is what I'm faced with, and so I'm asking you to help me, in effect. It may get you to think about other options, too. One is I can continue textbook writing at a reduced level. The royalties continue, but also at a reduced level. This is the phased retirement of the textbook. You see if your co-author is willing to take on more work for a greater share of the royalties. If your co-author is younger, you might be able to say, okay, instead of 50-50, I'll do a bunch of give me 40, you take 60, instead of, you know, by doing this and this, you take on. And he or she may think, that's okay for more bucks, because if they're younger than you, they're still working full-time, they may want to be building up the pension plan. And at times like this, building up the pension plan, the stocks are still reasonably low compared to what they were a few years ago, might make sense. So that's a possibility. Second one is find a younger colleague to be co-author and share the royalties. But he or she has to be willing to adopt your baby. Oh, man. That's tricky. To give somebody else your baby. I mean, just think of your own child that's, say, like 3 years old, and you give them to some friendly neighbor down the street. I mean, oh, wow. You're going to have that all the time. You're not going to trust. So I don't know about this. This is a tough one. And if you have multiple books, keep the simplest one and drop the rest. Just out of heck with it, pardon me. And let the publisher deal, find another author or something or other. And they will. Because they have in the contract, if you're not willing to do the next edition and you cannot help them find another co-author, they will go find one for you, you know, and replace you. And oftentimes you'll get royalties. Instead of the 50-50 split, your split may go down to 40, then down to 30, then down to 15, then down to 5, you know, that kind of stuff. Because the material you've got in the book is still significant, but it's getting less and less important. So that can go on for a while. Now, issues in finding a new co-author. And that could be a topic all in itself, I know. Characteristics, and I got, it's interesting, I put this together long before, but Michael Spigler, when he was presenting personal prerequisites for textbook writing, professional prerequisites, had a number of things that I thought were very good. What I came up with is the person must be young enough to do 3 or 4 more editions. And that means they've got to be in there probably early to mid-50s, something like that, assuming that they're going to stop when they hit retirement, but they may not. They must have tenure and be established in the field. You know, you don't want to get somebody. I've seen it happen. I know with at least one marketing textbook, a fella got his doctoral student who was off somewhere else, and before he got tenure, he was working as a second author on this book. The guy never got tenure, and now he's off at multiple other schools that, you know, trying to look for somebody who values textbooks. Third, it must be able to write well and do detail work. We know that, and this is important to writing well, but also the details. Fixing other people's work takes work on your part, and is that person willing to do the same thing? They must have a compatible vision of the book. Changing the book's orientation may drive away current users. If it's out in the 12th edition like ours is, you're not likely to pick up a whole bunch of new users unless you come up with something radically different. But if you come up with something radically different, then the people who have been buying your book will suddenly say, whoa, what happened to this thing? I expected this, and all of a sudden I get that. Why? This is terrible. So you're sort of stuck with your current users unless you change to make a different version of the textbook, somewhat for a different niche. So they've got to have a common vision. That author must be acceptable to current co-authors. And Tom and I have got to agree on who this third person is. And Tom is getting older and having more troubles with the book, but ego identifies with the book because he's the senior author. He was the first one with the book and will not give it up no matter what. And he's driving me nuts. But he came up with somebody first to do the instructor's manual, thank God. And hopefully now we're going to move the person in as a third author, and Tom and I both sort of move out. There may have to be a fourth author. How do you divide up the work and royalties? That's tricky. Should the transfer be gradual or abrupt? I think a lot of us want to move in slowly here. But then again, is it better just to say goodbye and move on and let the book be adopted and you're just out of it completely? Note, again, a point I make based on very little evidence, the books that don't make it to another edition, books don't often, sometimes, I know examples of books, we'll put it that way, when a new author takes over from an author who's basically retiring from the book, and pretty much the next edition doesn't appear. Something happens, the book doesn't have it, whatever it is. I've seen at least 2 editions where this has happened, where the new author is not able to keep the book going, and so it dies. So a problem with us is, Tom and I are taking this into the 13th edition. The 14th edition, when somebody else will take it over, that may be the absolute last edition because the chances of that young person, that new person keeping it going, maybe is only 50-50 bet. That's another reason not to give up the book if you wanted to keep it going. Second issue, drop off textbooks completely. Full retirement. Let the co-author take over your book. Your royalties are slowly phased out if your co-author is willing to do it and able to do it. Secondly, allow the publisher to find a replacement author. Your royalties, again, are slowly phased out, and hopefully they can find somebody. I've talked with my editors and said, how long do you think this book has got? It's good to have a discussion. Talk to your editor and say, how long, and I talked to the editor's boss, too. I said, I'm not sure, you know, how long I want to continue on this book. How many editions do you think it's got, from your point of view? And they said, they think three or four. They think so. And if we don't go ahead with it, they can always just sell that one edition for as long as they can make sales on it, you know, that kind of thing. So they could find another replacement offer. They could just let the thing die. I don't know. The book stops at 3-year retirement is another one. Your baby dies, your royalties abruptly end, or just slowly phase out because the publisher doesn't find a replacement, and neither do you. A third option is sort of almost what I'm doing now, soldiering on, which is you keep going until the publisher calls it quits or your health fails. That's sort of where you are right now. Yeah, until you get, you know, cancer or you know, the first stroke. No, serious folks, when you retire, one of the things to keep in mind is locate within a half an hour, a major medical facility. And that's why we're in St. Joe, because we're only 20 minutes to the hospital and 25 minutes to the hospital and 20 minutes to the various physicians we go to. In retirement, your social life is composed of doctor's appointments. You may not know that now, but when you're retired, you're in your 60s and your 70s, it's doctor's appointments. The chiropractor, the this, the that, the this, the that. Your wife, your husband, no, they got them, and it all multiplies, folks. I'm joking. I know that. But it's a serious consideration. That's when you're going to make that determination, when it's made for you. In other words, it's the simplest option, but it's a decision not to decide. And in teaching management, we always tell people a decision, if you don't decide, you say, no, I'm not going to deal with this. It's a decision. It's a decision not to decide. What you're really deciding is, I will not make the decision. I will let something else make the decision. My publisher will tell me no. My co-author will dump me, or whatever will happen. Or my health will go, or something else. You know, I'll be in a car wreck or something like that. That's you're letting fate make your decision for you. So be careful. Soldiering on is good if you love the subject matter and have no hobbies, no spouse, and you will want to avoid volunteer social work. So a good friend of mine, Max Wertman, who's been around many years, and his last spot was Iowa State University. I've known Max for many, many years. Max was in his 70s and still teaching full time. I said, Max, when are you going to retire? I'm going on phased retirement. I think it's great. Why don't you? No way. Why, Max? Why? He's, I know what happens to people when they retire. I don't want to become a volunteer social worker, which is what happens. Once they find you retired, oh, we need you for the your church. If you're a member of a church, we need you for the stewardship committee. The head of this, I'll be non-paid treasurer. You know, that's always good if you're in the business school. You can count, right? Good, put you in it. And on and on and on, this kind of stuff. And it's expected of you. And your peers are all talking about the volunteer activities. And it goes on and on and on. I mean, there's a whole series of things that happen. And you talk to people who are retired, they will tell you one thing uniformly. I've never been as busy in my life as I am now. They say that. They have no job. But they're very, very busy doing all kinds of things. But also, keep in mind, their energy level drops, so they can do less. So when you're saying busy, you're saying of what I can do, how much of that time is being filled up. And it is being filled up. The book's likely to become stale and outdated. How much excitement can I find in continuing to read and subscribe to those blankety-blank journals I've been reading for 40 years? I'm getting a little tired of it. And the trouble is, if I don't stay with it, what new am I going to add to the book? What new examples? How can I stay current with the students? I feel myself as I'm getting older and older, getting further and further away from the new technologies and the new thoughts and the new things. Okay, I'm on Facebook. Whoopee. I'm on LinkedIn, yeah, but I don't care. I don't check them. But I mean, there's a lot of younger generation who do this stuff and texting. I don't do that either. I got a cell phone here. I don't do any of this text stuff. Forget it. I'm still into audio things. So the problem is, how long can I actually keep mentally? Okay. Let me read my conclusion. I'm out of time and effort into writing this thing. I might as well at least. Okay. Having a successful textbook is a problem that many people would love to have. Okay? Let's face it. It's nice. The author of this paper is a co-author of two textbooks that are in the 12th and 5th editions, respectively, both with the same co-author. The author, me, is 69 years of age, 4 years into retirement from full-time teaching. I got no health issues at this time other than a little developing retinitis pigmentosa. If you're familiar with that, it's a disease of the eye, which means basically there's a likelihood I'll go blind within the next 10, 20 years. How long do I have? I mean, that's an issue. And that's an issue when I'm thinking about how long I need to be converting to things that are not visually oriented. And just part of life, you have to figure that way. Your co-author is retired, is in the mid-70s with a lot of health problems, prostate cancer, other kinds of things, knee surgeries, all kinds. Both authors like the extra money that comes from royalties and the recognition of being authorities in the field. We like that. The two co-authors are currently following the soldiering on alternative, but are finding it to be increasingly unsatisfactory. It's getting progressively harder for each of them to put forth a large effort required for a new edition. Book sales continue to be good. The publisher indicates that both books will be good for 3 or more editions. Finding other capable people who will be willing to adopt their books is not an easy chore. Even if new authors can be found, what sort of division of work and royalties make the most sense? Is a gradual transfer in authorship and royalties the best approach, or should the transfer be more abrupt? So suggestions and advice are welcome. That's it. I sense that that other people in my position don't have the same feelings as I do about it. So, yes.
On behalf of TAA, I'd like to suggest that one would take is to become more involved with TAA.
Another volunteer job, right? Great. Oh, the TAA pays for your travel?
Sure. If you get involved, get on the council with me.
Oh, I see. Oh. Okay, well, that could be okay then. Money talks.
The meeting is not always in Minneapolis.
Yeah, well, you know, it could be other places. Yeah, okay. Any other thoughts? Yes, sir.
I'd like to ask the group, I'm a solo author of 4 books, and I want to bring on collaborators and transfer a heavy load. So has anybody had experience with their first time around the track, a publisher paid work for hire for them, start the royalty sharing until the second time around the track? There's the second effort, or anybody had any experience with that?
Well, I had a minor thing. I was losing a couple of them and didn't know.
Oh, it's tied to the floor. I can't take it to you. It's being recorded, so they should get your question.
This I'm in the witness protection program, so this cannot go out because they know my voice. So the situation was this. I was losing a co-author, and I didn't know if I wanted to do the book solo, which, and I thought I might want to take on another author. I also needed a lot of help with one particular chapter, a new chapter that was going to go in the book. And this particular person I was considering really is an expert in that area, so he was perfect for that. And my editor wisely suggested that we have him just do that chapter as a work for hire, so that I could get a sense of how he wrote and what it was like to work with him and so forth. And it was a very wise suggestion, and he did do the work for me, and I will not be interested in taking him on as a co-author.
Ooh, interesting. Yeah, that issue of finding another author. What other experiences? Has anybody done that yet, or? Everybody's soldiering on? Happily, I assume. Anybody else have problems with writing text? Yes.
Well, I guess that I'm in a kind of middle position. I am a co-author and have been for 40 years. My senior co-author is 87. This Whoa. Is a chemistry lab manual. He was quite involved with the previous edition. His health is not so good. He did not choose to be involved any further, and we have collectively found a younger author at our institution. Okay. Interesting, this person does not have tenure. He has a PhD in chemistry from Caltech. He is, not that he was not on a tenure track position.
Oh.
He is our chemistry lab supervisor who sets up labs. He's rewritten some of ours, pirated them, I guess, for the local use, since they're no longer using our lab manual at our institution.
Yeah, no respect at home. Yeah.
Right, but he's quite good. He's enthusiastic. He wants to keep things going, and I think signs are he's working out okay. So anyway,
work for hire.
He will be a co-author at a yet to be determined percentage. That percentage will be determined when we submit the manuscript. He's okay with that. That's the way it was always done with me. That's the way.
Wow.
He's agreed to that.
Wow.
So anyway, it can work out.
Good.
Speaking not as a lawyer now, but in the days when I had my editor hat on, it was ordinary course of business for us in our succession planning to do fee-based arrangements with folks who may or may not have known what they were doing, but they were auditioning for a co-authorship role. So we would involve them doing instructor's manuals for a fee. Sometimes we would involve them on study guides or other royalty-bearing supplements, but that was a tryout experience. Sometimes we would have them write chapters. There were lots of different ways to get folks involved. Sometimes it started as far back as using them as reviewers first and letting them gradually work up, and obviously it takes a long time to do that, but it wasn't at all out of the ordinary, and I'd be surprised if there are publishers that you're working with that don't have that process in mind.
That's good to know. I have a hard time doing that because my co-author thinks the publishers are all evil spawn of hell, and as a result, he doesn't even want to let them know that he's looking for another co-author, so everything's on the QT right now. And so it's going to be interesting when the blankety-blank hits the fan and the editor finds out and they start wanting to get involved. At which point, they might have to actually talk with Tom. But usually what they'll do is they'll be talking to me saying, where, you know, and I'm going to have to go through this thing again.
Do they not know how old you are? I mean, how could it be a surprise?
No, they know. They understand that, yes. Good point. Good point. I haven't got anything further. I think we can take a break. And I guess lunch is what, quarter after 12? Thank you.
Authoring into Retirement, Too Much Invested to Quit, is an educational presentation brought to you by the Text and Academic Authors Association. For more TAA educational podcasts, go to www.taaonline.net/TAA teleconferences and click on podcasts or recordings.